Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. I'm really glad to be back in LA, and we're going to have a smashing show for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll hear an interview I did in New York with Tricia and Rob, the parents of a 27-year-old man who has been in the torture chamber of Rikers Island for the past 3 years on a minor traffic charge. And before that, by now people have seen, and if you haven't seen, pick up a newspaper, turn on the news, or go to the internet, and you'll see what's going on. The assault on filmmaker Quentin Tarantino by police forces all over the country. And what are they saying? They're saying he should shut up, that he's got no right to speak. They're threatening his livelihood and all this other stuff, and cop after cop after cop, police unions and all of that, getting in line to take a swing at him. Why? Because he called out police murder. He called out police who murder people, and he said he stood with the people who have been murdered and their families. So we'll be talking with attorney Martin Garbus, a trial lawyer and international defender of free speech, and David Zeiger, a documentary filmmaker, who's going to be talking with us about the assault on Jane Fonda and Gene Seberg, among others, by the FBI and other police forces, and what it means when artists step up and raise their voices, and why it's important to get behind them and support them. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to really give to you, present to you, a conversation I had with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, the co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and Rise Up October. He was also with Cornel West, the two people that actually called for Rise Up October way back when, and Rise Up October was 3 days of actions to stop police terror. Well, Carl's joining us to talk about what happened, what was accomplished, and what's next. So without any further ado, let's go for Carl. All right, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my guest, Carl Dix. Carl's a familiar voice to people who listen to the show regularly and a very important voice in the world today. Carl has been, along with Cornel West, was the initiator of the Rise Up October events, and he played a huge role in all 3 days. And we're here to talk to him about what happened, what was important about what happened in Rise Up October, and some various other questions, including plans for where to go from here. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
So let's jump into this. Tell people what happened in Rise Up October. I mean, I was there. It was a stunning event in a lot of ways. Let's talk about what happened.
Well, what Rise Up October was three powerful days of resistance with the overall theme of stop police terror, which side are you on? And we delivered that message through the 3 days of activity, beginning with Thursday, October 22nd in Times Square, No More Stolen Lives, Say Their Names. And we had about 40 families of people murdered by police, together with prominent voices of conscience, including people like Jamal Joseph, the former Black Panther and a current professor and filmmaker, Eve Ensler, playwright, director of the Vagina Monologues, Quentin Tarantino, religious figures like Reverend McCrory and Reverend Phelps, Martin Garbus, an attorney, and a bunch of other people who together read the names of a few hundred people killed by police, a few hundred out of the thousands and thousands, and the family members told the story of their murdered loved one, not just how their loved one's life had been stolen by police, but also who that person was, recapturing their humanity, and just giving people a sense of the widespread nature of this problem and the humanity of the lives being lost. Then that afternoon, we ended up over in Brooklyn at a march and rally marking the 20th annual National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation. Then on Friday, we went to Rikers Island, the second largest penal institution in the country, which is a combination debtor's prison and torture chamber. And our aim in that was shut down Rikers. That was our theme of the day. And Rikers actually was shut down for 1 or 2 hours through our action, and 16 of us got arrested for delivering that message. And then on Saturday, we culminated with the rally and march through the middle of Manhattan, taking our message of stop police terror, which side are you on? 100 families of people murdered by police were there and led the march, and All of them spoke at the rally. There were also speakers like myself, Cornel West, Quentin Tarantino, Eve Ensler, Gina Belafonte. And that was the culmination of the 3 days of powerful resistance, Rise Up October, with a message delivered of stop police terror, which side are you on?
You know, Carl, one of the things that I sussed out as I was there, not sussed out, actually, just it just really was overwhelming, was the power, the morality, the moral power of, I mean, there's the element of all of the people who were there, both the people, the more prominent people, as well as the people who were marching and the prominent people who were marching right there in the middle of the crowd, marching with everyone else. There was that certainty of we were morally right to be doing this. And that was really added to by the presence and the voices of the family, both the presence at the head of the march and the voices as they spoke out. This was a remarkable coming together of those two elements.
Yeah, because, see, that's the thing about it. This is real. We are not hyping this up. We are not trying to make it to be more than it is. It is the case that police are killing hundreds of people every single year. I mean, they are up. It's about 950 people killed by police since January 1st. And the police's own information indicates that 300 plus of those people have been unarmed. And that's according to their figuring. And we know that when they talk about people being armed, it's sometimes armed with cell phones and different things like that. But this is the widespread nature of it. And that's why people feel like they have right on their side when they step out to say that this must stop, because they know how many people it's happening to. They know how unjust it is. And more people are having their eyes open to that and feeling challenged to get off the sidelines, to stop feeling like there's some neutral position you can take when these kind of horrors are being perpetrated. And that was part of the point to Rise Up October, to deliver that kind of challenge, to get people to understand that their inaction comes down to complicity in allowing this to continue to happen, and that it really is up to us to act to stop it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl, I had the opportunity to hear you speak the day after Rise Up October, the day after the march. And you spoke to something I think is important to bring out to people as well. The fact that while it was really very good, and I think this polarization, which we'll talk about in a minute, is extremely important and really needs to actually be on a whole different level. And that relates to what I was going to ask you is, you know, you mentioned that all the things that were good about this, at the same time, we have to be actually pretty fearlessly honest, and like there needed to be more people than there were there.
Yeah, because there were like 4,000 to 5,000 people, and we really were aiming for more, and we need to have more people standing up and act to stop this, saying this has got to stop. Because it really does have to become something that tears society apart, that there are so many people who are refusing to take this anymore. And challenging people who are continuing to stand aside, continuing to believe the lying justifications that go down. You know, and you can look at just the two videos that have been released this week from South Carolina to get a sense of what I mean by people continuing to accept the lying justifications. And one that I'm going to speak to now is the video of the young woman who was sitting in class and apparently had her phone out at a time when the teacher didn't think she should. And she gets just manhandled by a cop who grabs her, throws her across the room, beats her down, and arrests her. And then when another student said, "Why are you doing that to her?" she got arrested too. Now, this cop has the nickname of Officer Slam. That's a nickname the students have given to him, and that's because he does that to people. But this is the first time it's been on video. And the other times that people have complained about what he did to them, he has been exonerated by the police department, even by the courts. So just think about what it means that this guy goes around and does this and gets away with it, and even gets backed up by the school authorities in it, because they interviewed the school authorities who backed him up in this. But then the video gets out, and they're like, oh, this is horrible. We can't have this going on. And they fire the guy. Well, they're firing him because everybody found out about it. See, and that's the thing. We have right on our side. These are widespread horrors that are happening. And that's even why the FBI director was making this noise about cops feel under siege from youth with cell phones, because they don't want to back off of committing these horrors against people. They actually need the cops as their frontline enforcers for that. They just don't want it being recorded and spread so that everybody can find out about it. And we actually need to get it spread, and to spread along with it a challenge that people have to stop taking this. They have to stop allowing it to go down. They have to stop suffering in silence. But also, if it's not happening to you, you got to stop standing aside. It is wrong to do that, and it is right to stand up and resist.
All right. Now, in that context, I want to ask you about the thing that actually a lot of people noticed, a lot of people heard about, is this just massive assault. You want to talk about polarization, and someone with right on their side who stood up and said what had to be said, and the polarization that has occurred with the immediate attack from the system on Quentin Tarantino. Can we talk about that just a little?
Yeah, that's important to talk about, because what is at play here is that a message is being delivered by the police unions, the NYPD, Chief Pig, and the other forces that are attacking Tarantino. And that message is, if you're a prominent person in this society, don't even think about criticizing the brutality and murder that the police enforce in inner cities all across the country. Don't even think about it, because if you do, this is what could be done to you. And to me, it brings to mind a mafia protection racket. Only in this case, the payoff that's being demanded isn't cash. It's towing a political line. And basically what they're saying is, hey, Mr. Tarantino, you got a nice operation here, these films that you make. It would be a shame if somebody made it impossible for you to keep making them. And that's exactly what they're doing, because they're not only talking about boycotting his films. There has been, like, Mark Furman of infamy from his role when he was on the LAPD in the O.J. Simpson case and other activity that he was involved in, said that the cops needed to go beyond a boycott to refusing to grant Tarantino permits for his filming and to refuse to grant him protection. So it is really a thuggish protection racket thing, demanding a political payoff. And the message isn't just to Tarantino, it's to everybody. And it's been very important that people have been issuing statements in support of Tarantino and in opposition to these attacks on him. You know, people like Noam Chomsky, Arturo O'Farrell, Cornel West, the National Coalition Against Censorship has issued a statement, as well as we're collecting statements from some of the family members of police murder victims who participated in Rise Up October. And it's going to be very important for people to have his back and to make real clear to him that he's him and others, that somebody who stands up and says police terror must stop is not going to be left alone to face the blowback from that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Charles Burnett, amazing.
See, that's what I mean. Yeah. I forgot.
Well, Charles came out with a statement that I really valued a lot, because it was sort of in the way he is, he made a statement, a very powerful statement, and then at the end of it he says, and by the way, I think I'm going to be going to see every film that Tarantino makes. So it was kind of very good, Charlie. Anyway, Carl, one of the things I wanted to talk about, and we're coming up on our time, but first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, Rise Up October, and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about the most recent Rise Up October events in New York City. Now, Carl, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, too, is that, you know, this polarization that you're talking about,
this putting that question out there of which side are you on, and it gets answered in a certain way through the Rise of October events. It needs to be answered in a broader, more powerful way as we go along, because there is the reality that if it just stayed where it was, then it's going to go in another direction. And it could happen very quickly, both through the efforts of the other side, but also through people just falling away from it. There's a real element of this being real and the need to pursue things now from a good starting point or a good place where the movement is at. But where do we go from here?
Yeah, that's very important because, and I said this from the stage on Saturday, this was not the end of anything. It has to be the beginning. We can't pat ourselves on the back and go home and feel good about ourselves. We have to continue building off of this because the authorities are out to crush this movement of resistance. They have been stung by the resistance that people have built, and it has challenged the legitimacy of what they do on this front, and they want to stop it. They want to hit people with mass arrests, threats of heavy charges, and also entice people into getting back within the channels of the system, lobbying politicians for running for president, sitting down and having meetings with them, and sucking them off into, well, this is the way you should go at this, not building mass determined resistance. So we have to continue to build this resistance and continue to build off of what was accomplished through Rise Up October. And we have some very serious plans for doing that. The first is nationwide activity around the murder of Tamir Rice. November 22nd is going to be 1 year since that murder was carried out by police in Cleveland. Still no justice, so we have to take to the streets on November 22nd. And if the grand jury comes down with a decision, because they recently impaneled the grand jury around this case before the 22nd, then we have to act then. December 3rd, 1 year since the police who murdered Eric Garner were exonerated. That's going to be another day of nationwide action. And then February of 2016, we're going to launch a Stolen Lives tour that takes family members of people murdered by police around the country, speaking at college campuses, speaking in communities, continuing to spread the understanding that this is a widespread horror that's happening, not isolated incidents, not tragic accidents, but it is actually the concentration of a genocidal assault targeting black people and broad sections of Latinos. And we're going to be organizing through the course of this to spread this movement, to strengthen it all across the country.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today. And we're going to keep in touch with you as usual, but especially in these coming months, really making certain that, you know, we're really pitching in terms of making this the kind of response it needs to be.
Thank you for having me on. And just let me say, people who want more information or want to get involved, go to the website stopmassincarceration.net, riseupoctober.org, and revcom.us.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today, and looking forward to hearing from you again real soon, man.
Yes, thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, that was Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and Rise Up October. And we'll be having Carl back often in the coming months as we proceed along this very critically important battle in society around police murder and brutality. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to continue our conversation about police brutality and murder and those who dare to stand up against it. So stay tuned.
Frightening when you hit a rat at that sound. 26, 27, every 28 hours, put another body under that ground. Where the governor, he absent.
All right, welcome back. That was Jasiri X with Don't Let Them Get Away With Murder. All right, important for everyone to remember these days. Do not let them get away with murder. As people know, I was in New York City for Rise Up October, reporting on it, doing my show from WBAI, and also just recording a lot of stuff. We're going to be working on a whole program about the event. But really, one of the things that I thought was really important was how deeply everybody felt that was there about what has been happening and the need to stop it, the family members, other people who spoke. And in particular, one of those people was Quentin Tarantino, the filmmaker. And he said, here's what he said, okay? He said, hey, everybody, I got something to say, but actually I would like to give my time to the families that want to talk. I want to give my time to the families. However, I just do also want to say, what am I doing here? I'm here because I am a human being with a conscience. And when I see murder, I cannot stand by. And I have to call the murdered the murdered. And I have to call the murderers the murderers. Now I'm going to give my time to the families. That was a statement. And on those few sentences, an entire campaign has been built up to come after Quentin Tarantino, to destroy him professionally and to isolate him and further put a cloud, put a threat of retaliation on anyone who dares to stand up and criticize and come out against police brutality and murder. Joining us to talk about this are two people who've been on the show before, and I'm really happy to have them here. First is Martin Garbus, and Martin is he's an attorney. It's a little kind of not enough to say he's a trial attorney, although he is. He's a trial lawyer and an international defender of free speech and had some amazing cases, defended some amazing people, and has made a difference in the world. We're also joined by David Zeiger, a really great filmmaker who's made a number of films that I have really enjoyed, and I think have actually made a difference in how people perceive the world and the necessity of them to stand up and do something about it. And David's joining us in studio. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, you heard what I read from Quentin Tarantino, and you right. Being in New York, you've seen the kind of the response from the police. Let's talk about this. What do you think about this whole response from the police to what Tarantino has done?
I think that the police are being, both in L.A. and New York, are being shockingly stupid in even doing this. In other words, a man gets up at this very emotional rally. He says exactly what you said. And then to say, because he said that, that one should not see his films or that his films are all about violence. I think it's clear, of course, it's a free speech issue. But beside that, it's just preposterous. It just shows how removed the police are and the police spokesmen are from what's going on in the country. I mean, I could not have imagined that the police in two different states would try and do something like this. It was a very moving rally. I spoke at it. Quentin Tarantino spoke at it. I just read the names of the people who were killed and something about the way in which they were killed and what happened and the passion of the people there, the family members, relatives, brothers, fathers, sisters. It was wonderful. And to go after Tarantino is just, aside the fact that it's offensive and terrible, it's just incredibly stupid. And it's just showing how the leaders of the police force are not paying attention, two states, are not paying attention to what's going on in the country and are just creating a wider and wider gulf between them and the people they're supposed to serve. I mean, it's just shocking what they did. It's not just a violation of free speech, et cetera. It's not just something bad. What it shows, the deeper issue, the profound separation between police leadership and the people.
Well, you know, Martin, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because, you know, my feeling about this is actually that, you know, in a lot of ways, the police stepped up because they were facing, I mean, you were at those rallies. That rally was the one on Thursday and then the big march on Saturday. Those things were so powerful. And including, like, in both times, the family members of people who have been killed by the police. And they've had to live with this, oftentimes in total isolation and quiet until this movement began to come together. And then people come together and they tell the stories of people who've only been statistics in a paper or some kind of just whacked out exaggeration of what went on, painting the police as sort of victims. And when you look at this thing, what happened was this movement is actually making an advance. And this is challenging one of the very, very important pillars on which this whole society rests in terms of keeping people in line and guaranteeing that the security of the system itself. And you have this thing where they come out and they start talking about, well, this is calling for the murder of police. This is calling for, you know, this is just this horrible that it, and there was an article in the LA Times about, and the idea that this just happened on, you know, just shortly after a police officer was killed in East Harlem, and as if there was any connection between the two.
Right.
You know, and you look at this, and I kept thinking about this. One of the things you've done is you've really stood up and you fought around this idea. I mean, I was thinking, you know, you've defended, you know, an artist. Actually, you want to talk about an artist that was always getting in trouble? You were the attorney for Lenny Bruce. And it was a lot of the way that he got assaulted when he began to stick a pin in the balloon of what the society is supposed to be about. What do you think is the real danger in terms of this overall question in society? Not so much the stupidity of the police force, although even I'll tell you this thing, it's actually even more than just two states. Philadelphia now has it, and who knows where it's going to spread. You know, that these cops are coming up and saying that Tarantino's work should be boycotted, and some have even said that he shouldn't be allowed to, you know, that they won't work on films in the cities, you know, this kind of stuff. So it's kind of...
Well, it's not arguable any longer that there have been murders. In other words, what the police are doing, maybe they could have said 10 years ago when it wasn't true. But everybody knew that it was true. But now, given the events of the last period of time, it's impossible to say that a man who says there were murders should somehow be punished. I mean, everybody says there were murders. It's not arguable. Grand juries are indicting people. People are going on trial. So to say that there are no murders, or it's wrong to articulate that there are murders, is just to be totally divorced from what's going on. It's like people from another planet. That's what's so astonishing about it.
Well, let me ask you this, Martin, because one of the things that you said in your statement, you said he is to be complimented and acknowledged for his truthful remarks at this rally. He accurately helped describe his view of a terrible problem in America today, and we should support him, not chastise him, for using his voice in the defense of freedom. Let's talk about that concept right now in terms, because that's actually a big part of, they're going after Quentin, certainly, and they're also trying to spread a certain atmosphere in society, a clampdown atmosphere, where if you dare to stand up and speak the truth, we'll hit you hard, and you deserve it.
Right. You know, I think that it's just an acceleration by the police in reaction to the ripping away of the concept that the police have gotten away with for so long, the idea that there is not something like prosecutions for driving while black, that grand juries really are free, you know, forget about that old shibboleth, they can indict a ham sandwich, that grand juries are free and do what's appropriate and that there's justice. The whole idea that the legal system, U.S. attorneys, prosecutors, grand juries, are independent bodies, free from prejudice and race, you can't believe that any longer. And so the police now to come out and say that just shows how far removed they are from what everybody else in America knows.
Okay, Martin, we're gonna as I told you when I talked to you about, we have another guest coming on, and we're going to have
Great.
To split this time, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Great.
Anything you'd like to say
thank
closing
you.
Out?
Thank you.
Bye. All right. No. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you again soon, man. Take care. All right. That was Martin Garbus, an American attorney, an attorney in this country who's actually fought some really intense cases around freedom of speech, including he was the attorney for Lenny Bruce when Lenny Bruce was coming under attack by all kinds of police authorities. Joining us now is my old friend and the, actually, really, really, I have to say, every time he's on, I have to tell him, you're a really great filmmaker, man. I really love your work. I worked with him on a couple of his series, Senior Year, that was on public television, and his film, Sir, No, Sir, which really broke open a tale that had not been told and needed to be told, and had a lot of lessons for people, which was about all the GIs and the resistance movement during the Vietnam War from inside the military. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for what you said, and thanks for having me again.
Sure. Since I have you sitting in studio, I can stare you in the eyes and say, yes, answer me, Svengali. But here's the thing. When you heard about this, I mean, Quentin Tarantino being literally, I mean, it was moments after he spoke that they were just like starting to start up the mills. And they were taking everything he said, and they were taking all this other stuff as the grist for their assault. And they actually launched a fairly significant and, I think, very dangerous campaign against Quentin Tarantino for speaking up and telling the truth about this. What do you think?
Well, the thing that immediately strikes me about it is how significant it is when important cultural figures, people like Quentin Tarantino, take a stand like this, that it's not a small thing. It's a very big thing. And a lot of times, it, you know, people deride it and say, oh, you know, the people are just doing it for publicity or they have a lot of money or whatever. But when someone like him or anyone in the film industry, anyone who has, who's a popular figure, takes a stand like that, what they do is that they draw a connection between their popularity and the mainstream culture or the culture that they're part of and this movement and this issue. And it has a tremendous amount of power. I mean, the reality is the fact that Quentin Tarantino came forward and was part of this played a big role in at least in the media paying attention and having to address it and having to talk about what happened. And of course, it also, because of that and in that context, drew the most intense fire from the police department. And, you know, there's, of course, an aspect of it that the police have now publicized what happened on Rise Up October in a way way beyond what could have been done without them. You know, so there's a good aspect to it. But the other fact is that these threats from authority figures, from police particularly, and police agencies are extremely serious and they are extremely real. They're not idle threats. And of course, one of the things that I've looked into in my work, particularly in the film Sir No Sir and looking at the GI movement and in my own history with that, was how in the 1960s and 1970s that particular celebrities, people who had played that kind of role in the anti-war movement or in support of the Black Panther Party, were subject to very intense campaigns from the FBI, from local police, et cetera, that had a very, in one case with Gene Seberg, a deadly impact.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is stuff that people don't always get. I mean, particularly people from, you know, you and I were around during that period.
Right.
And even some of the people who were around during that period have forgotten what things that they should never have forgotten. And the fact that these threats are not idle threats, they're not just cops being blowhards or being stupid. They are actual threats. And there are times, there have been many times where they have played this out. I mean, you could even think about somebody like Judy Barry, who was like assassinated basically in relation to her political work. Mm-hmm. And she was an activist. But you look at somebody like Jean Seberg, and we'll talk a little bit later about Jane Fonda as well, because she also suffered a tremendous amount in relation to this. Let's talk about Jean Seberg. Tell people who she is and what happened.
Jean Seberg was an actress, a young actress in the 1960s. She was became known worldwide for her role in Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless, which is still a film that, you know, every film student sees, and it still has tremendous impact. And it was a huge success. And she became a very well-known celebrity, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. She was an American. And in 1970, she supported, as did many, many people, the Black Panther Party, who, interestingly, were at that time were the main target of police departments around the country and the FBI. And there was a concerted campaign to destroy the Black Panther Party. And she contributed money and spoke out in support of the Panthers. In response to that, the FBI, under the direction of a particular agent named Richard Held, who was very close to Hoover and worked closely with Hoover, who was the head of the FBI, launched a campaign, and it's this is very significant. The terms that he used, the goal of the campaign that he said was to cause her embarrassment and cheapen her image. And that term, cheapen her image, I think is very significant because, again, they recognized when that when someone who has that kind of image, who has that kind of impact, takes that kind of stand, it draws a connection, and it has to be destroyed from their perspective. The way he did it was he spread a rumor that she was pregnant at the time. She was married. He spread a rumor that the father of the baby was a Black Panther. He actually wrote a phony letter to a gossip columnist for the LA Times who picked it up, printed it, and Newsweek then also picked it up and printed it. This is in the middle of her pregnancy. She went into a deep depression because of this, and she miscarried. Well, she didn't miscarry. I'm sorry. It was a premature birth. Her daughter was born and died 2 days later. She did something remarkable, by the way, that's similar to the Emmett Till situation. When her baby was buried, she publicly held the baby in her arms to show that the baby was white, which her husband was white. She was white. And to show that this vicious rumor was a lie. And it also destroyed her emotionally. She never recovered from that, and several years later succeeded in committing suicide. It was right after she committed suicide that the documents that showed this campaign were revealed. And nothing that I've said here is conjecture. This is all something that was actually written about by the FBI, by Agent Held, and it's part of history.
Yeah, and people need to realize this thing, is that this woman's life was actually, was literally destroyed. Her career was destroyed. Basically, even the way the way people looked at her in society, for whatever reason, and no matter what, whether it was a bunch of knuckleheads that were just knuckle-dragging people walking down the street, they actually had this focus around, this is terrible. This person is terrible. And it was all because of what she represented of. Look, the FBI and the system had Nixon in particular, had a big bone to pick with all these artists that were out there right. saying stuff about the Panthers. I mean, you remember, this is when Leonard Bernstein was holding fundraisers in his apartment for the BPP, for the Black Panther Party.
Right.
You know,
right.
And they had an interest in trying to just basically jam a crowbar in between the movement and these voices of conscience, these prominent voices of conscience.
Right.
Which
right.
leads us to Jane Fonda as well. So let's talk about that a little.
That's a complex and fascinating story, because Jane Fonda, initially, what brought her into being very active in the anti-war movement were the soldiers, were the GIs, was the GI movement. The first years of her activism, she traveled around the country and went to coffee houses where GIs were organizing against the war and spoke with them and learned from them and listened. And it was through, ironically, it was through the soldiers that she became an anti-war activist, ironically, because the mythology that's been permeated since then was that she, betrayed the soldiers and every veteran hates Jane Fonda. But in fact, at the time, she was beloved by thousands and thousands of soldiers. She did a tour, anti-war variety show, the FTA show, that tens of thousands of GIs went to, including in Asia, when the show went to Asia. And people loved it. And they loved the stand that she was taking. And they loved, and in fact, the majority of soldiers in 1970-71, when she was doing this, were opposed to the war, actively opposed to the war. It wasn't until... It was in the context of the Nixon administration attempting to pretty much the term that was used then was reverse the verdict on the war, was to claim that the war was lost not because it was an unjust imperial war that was defeated by the Vietnamese people, but because the American people were betrayed. They betrayed the soldiers, they betrayed the veterans, the war movement betrayed them. And in that context, Jane Fonda became the prime suspect, the prime target, the person who was subject to FBI, CIA, all of this stuff, by the way, has been revealed through Freedom of Information Act. Every police agency in the country had a campaign against Jane Fonda. Whenever she came into a town, she would be surveilled. She would be in Cleveland. She was arrested and on several phony charges that were eventually dropped. She was hounded. She was hounded. And for a period of time was simply not able to work in the industry. It took her becoming her own producer. And by the way, there's the other side of the story is the fact that there were a lot of people at that time, also prominent people, also people in the film industry who stood by her and who stood with her and supported her. And it was because of that that she was able to continue to make films. It was only because of that that she was able to continue. And she made her best films in that period of time because they were the films that, that were expressing her political views and that she was in charge of. So there's lessons on both sides, I think, from her experience of how viciously she was attacked, but also what made it possible for her to survive that.
And that's important. And I think one of the things that actually really struck me, too, as I was just preparing for this interview, it struck me, I had forgotten that actually this stuff continued all the way up into the 90s, where you were getting these reactionary rabid attacks, these right. frothing animals coming out to attack her and completely making things up. And even after it was shown that they were made up, they still had a life that went on and on and on. To this day, still goes on.
Right. Yeah, it's the old, the bigger the lie, the more it can survive. The truth, it does continue to go on. It's interesting because she still is this kind of symbol for every kind of rabid defense of American imperialism. As Jane Fonda, the traitor, There's a whole element of it, of the fact that she was a woman. That's another story there too. That added to the vitriol, you know, that was thrown at her.
Now we're running up on our time, unfortunately, yeah. But I wanted to get this out because it's also, you know, one of the things that actually is good about Jane Fonda is the situation with Jane Fonda too. Is that Jane Fonda actually never really shut up. You know, there was a period where she got a little quieter or got a little defensive and whatever. But actually, you know, she spoke out against the Iraq War. She's spoken out against all kinds of things. She's been active in that sense. But there's a point here, and there's a point that they do this. They go after people like this, and like they're going after Tarantino now. There's a point of shutting them up, shutting them down.
Right.
But it's not just to get those individuals. There's a much bigger agenda at play here. Let's talk about that a little bit. The importance of people speaking out, as you started to talk about earlier, and also the need for people. Why is it important for people to stand up and defend these people?
Right. That's the thing. I mean, there are two sides to this thing that I think that strike me. One, as I said earlier, how important and how significant it is that someone like Quentin Tarantino and anyone in the film, you know, in the film world, people who are celebrities, people who have a voice, people who are popular, people who, you know, make films or act in films that people like to see. It gives, for lack of a better way to put it, it lends a legitimacy, a broad legitimacy to the movement, to the issues that are being fought out. And I think in this case, in a lot of ways, the police and the authorities know that better than we do. And they know how powerful that is. And they will do everything to, you know, cut it off at the knees. In that context, it also, and I think this is, again, part of the lesson of Jane Fonda, it's critical, particularly for people in that industry, in that world, to stand up and stand with someone who comes under attack like that. Not just because they could come under attack too, but because it broadens the base of opposing this stuff. I mean, the other side of it, by the way, is what are these cops defending? That's the other thing. You know, you got to look at what are they defending? They're defending the right of the police to act with impunity and to murder and for the whole system to back them up. That's what they are defending by going after Tarantino. So there are two sides that are very, very clearly delineated right now in the context of the attacks on him.
Now, we're going to have to wrap this up, but actually my assistant producer just made a note to remind me that, you know, actually, and you and I talked about this because you were involved in actually bringing FTA, the documentary, back to the surface and back to actually being seen out in society, that for many decades, that documentary was suppressed.
Yeah, it was absolutely suppressed, and it lived in the basement of the Academy because when it was released, the film of Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland's tour, anti-war tour, to military bases all over the world, played for 1 week in theaters and was picketed and attacked by a lot of right-wing forces and was pulled.
Okay, that was filmmaker David Zeiger, and before that, attorney Martin Garbus, talking about the assault on filmmaker Quentin Tarantino for the remarks he made standing with people whose family members have been murdered by police. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was the Friday the 13th concert at Cook County Jail with Jimmy McGriff, George Freeman, Lucky Thompson, and others. When I was in New York City for the Rise Up October events, I met a couple who had heard Carl Dix and Cornel West talking about Rise Up October on a local radio station. They came to a meeting of people building for Rise Up October and wanted to be part of the events. I had the chance to talk with Tricia and Robert about their son, who has been locked up in the infamous Rikers Island prison for more than 3 years. All right, I'm sitting here in the chapel of a church. And I'm talking with Trish and Rob, who are from the New York area. Their son has been in Rikers Island since how long?
Since 2012.
Okay, so 3 years. Three years. I guess I'll ask you first, Trish, and then Rob will come over to you. When I first met you, you told me you had something you wanted to talk about in relation to your son and what's happening in Rikers Island. How did your son end up in Rikers Island?
On a reckless endangerment charge.
What does that mean?
From what they were saying, reckless endangerment, driving a car.
Just driving a car?
Driving recklessly, so they say.
And he ended up in Rikers Island, in a prison, in a brutal prison for
reckless endangerment.
That's very heavy because you're sitting there and I'm thinking, like, so what has happened? If 3 years is a very long time to be in a jail for reckless endangerment. That's right. Sort of something like you would get a traffic ticket for, right?
Right.
Yes.
Yes. But what happened? They've been going on with the case, and he has not been charged with the crime.
Let me get this straight. He hasn't been charged with the crime, but he's been sitting in Rikers Island prison for 3 years.
Right. He's been in prison for 3 years. He's not gone to trial or anything, but he's been sitting there. The second case, he was in Rikers Island for reckless endangerment, which the second case got dismissed. It got dismissed, and they're holding him on a first case going back to 2011.
How old is your son?
27,
so he was 24 when he got thrown into this place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they had two cases against him then?
Yes.
Okay, and then they threw one out, and they still kept one, but there's never been a trial or an indictment?
They indicted him on 2011 case, and that's the case he's been fighting since 2011. And when he got arrested a second time, that case got thrown out, dismissed. So right now, he's still fighting the 2011 case.
What kind of conditions, now I know you go to visit him, what kind of conditions is he living under in Rikers Island? What's happening to him?
Yeah, he got very sick in Rikers Island. Because he got attacked by a CO in there. They kicked him in the groin 3 times, and now he got cancer in Rikers Island. He's very sick in Rikers Island right now.
He's got cancer and he's in Rikers Island.
He got cancer. Okay. Since he's been in Rikers Island, he got cancer.
Is he getting treatment for the cancer?
He's getting treatment there because we have legal prisoners' rights involved, which is helping us. We have other people helping us, legal people stepping in, because at first he wasn't getting any treatment. When he got rushed to the emergency room for being attacked by the CO, after he was released on August 28th, he was supposed to go back to the hospital in 3 weeks. They kept prolonging his medical treatment. And then when he did get rushed back, he had to be rushed back immediately again due to not having the treatment. They found out that the cancer had spread it. And the doctor said if they would have brought him back in the 3 weeks process like they should have, it wouldn't have been aggressive. Now it's at a point of aggressiveness. And he's very sick. He's losing weight. We're just fighting. We're just fighting for him. We're hoping we can resolve it, get him the medical treatment, because they released him and they sent him back to Rikers Island. He did nothing but throw up the whole time he's been there. And they took him down to the infirmary to give him something to help him until he gives back to the doctor for more treatment.
Your son has been in Rikers Island for 3 years, and you've gone to visit him. I'd like people to know, because as I said, people who don't live in New York don't know about Rikers Island, the fact that it's called the Abu Ghraib of New York, it's called the Guantanamo of New York. And that means, you know, the kind of thing when people know the treatment, where people are tortured literally or tortured mentally, or all kinds of things are done or not done to them. What happened to your son in Rikers Island?
Well, he's going through a lot there. It hasn't been easy for him nor us. He's been in several fights in there with inmates attacking each other. But most serious injury that has really like took us to another level is when he was injured by that CO that tried to almost viciously try to kill him. He was rushed immediately to the hospital to have surgery, or else he would have died. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. And I want people to know, because I met another lady. I'm not the only mother, but maybe I'm the only mother who's speaking public. But I've met mothers who had some horror stories. And it shouldn't be. If you're going to be judged by the court system, why be judged by the prison system, too?
Well, you know, in a way, a lot of that actually comes down to, too, these prison systems aren't meant to do anything. There's no such thing as rehabilitation. Rehabilitation from what? When half the people that are... Look, a lot of the people that are in Rikers have never even gone to court. Go ahead.
But what happens, a lot of people go to Rikers Island, sometimes don't go to court for like 6-7 years. They give them a high bail to keep them in there. The judge give them a high bail to keep them in there. And I think that's wrong. And Rikers Island is like an animal place. Mm-hmm. You get in fights in there. The COs beat you up in there, stomp you out in there. They treat you like an animal in there and everything. So it's a terrible place to be at. It's terrible. I think they should be closed down, mm-hmm. You know. But you got to do it the right way to close it down. It's some kind of way you could do it, but you got to do it the right way.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Tricia and Rob, a couple whose son has been locked up on the Rikers Island prison chamber for more than 3 years for a traffic violation.
Give people a sense of what your son's like.
Oh, he's not the same.
Well, what was he like before he went to Rikers Island?
Outgoing. He was outgoing, very friendly person, good-hearted person. And he had a lot of talents. He got a lot of gifts. And to see him, so he's like mentally unstable. He was beaten in the head so bad.
I found this is in Rikers Island.
In Rikers Island, that I found a paper where something happened to the side of his brain. And that's another issue I have to address soon, too. And he's not himself. He's very, he don't remember. He does a lot of stuttering since he's been hit in the head so many times. He's had a surgery where some part of his body parts had to be removed due to the attack. You know, no mother should have to live like this with their children in Rikers Island. And it deals with the court system. The mass incarceration comes from the court system. It should be nobody should be sitting in a prison in Rikers Island for 5 or 6 years. Nobody. And there should be programs made available to help these young men. It's just so much to say in such a short period of time, but he was always an outgoing person. Everybody loved him. Everybody. He would help you if he could. He would give you whatever he had in his pocket. He's very educated, very intelligent. Everybody loved him, but right now his mind is gone. His spirit is gone. Matter of fact, I'm not even allowed to go see him anymore.
Wait a minute. You're not allowed to go visit anymore? Why?
My son asked me not to come back because he says that he's ready to die.
Say that again.
He says to me, don't come back. Because he says he don't care no more. He's ready to die. Whatever's going to happen, he said cancer's going to kill him. He's ready to die and he's going to refuse treatment. And he says that he's not going to take treatment anymore. So I'm going to try to see will he see me by myself. But he can deny my visit if he chooses to. But I know how he is, and when he's losing faith, and he's losing his strength, and he's very sick because he's eating them. He has no food in his system to fight this cancer, and the system don't care. It's all about money and how many people you can get incarcerated. And he's a young kid. It should have been some type of way we could have resolved it, where it wouldn't have had to come to this. But it's a lot involved. People don't know.
Now, you told me when we were talking on the phone, you said that it's also had this very deep impact on you, and nobody can hear your story without their heart breaking and being with you. At the same time, you've talked about it's devastated you financially.
Financially.
Tell us about that. How did that happen?
Oh, financially, it just broke me up. Everything I have, all my resources are gone. They just see me coming. They see you coming with money,
yeah,
and they just...
Especially lawyers.
They just take you for what you got and keep you hanging on. And the more you pay, the less they'll get due for you. Very, very... It's just... Financially, I lost my apartment. I lost my apartment. I have no more money.
What was it that they were taking money from you? What were they saying they would do if you gave them money?
They would represent him. Yeah. They would try to...
Less time.
They would do this. They would promise this. Right. Look into it. Tell him about less of time. But yet and still, there was a lot of discrepancies in the case. And the more you would ask them, the more nastier they would get. Yeah. And disrespectful they would get. But... At the end of the day, I realized it wasn't about trying to resolve it. It was about how much money they could get. The more money they get, the more time they'll keep you lingering on. Just like I heard a man on the news last week say he was fighting the case. And when he ran out of money, his attorney dropped his case and left him. By the grace of God, he said some man stepped in to help him. And financially, I've paid everything I could.
You've lost your apartment. Where are you living? How are you living now?
I live with my mother. I moved back in with my mother. And I owe everybody
in the books, because people did come forward to help me donate for this, with the case. You know, you just can't get no head and tail to these, what's going on. And sometimes you could ask certain questions where you know that the lawyers get angry with you because you're asking it. You shouldn't be asking. And sometimes any mother that's out there listening to this, you do not take what someone tell you and say they're right. You should know your child. If you don't, you try to find out. Seek and you shall find. And sometimes it may cost you, it may put you in danger, but sometimes you need to seek your own information. You can't depend on everybody to come to you to tell you what you need to know. And unfortunately, the criminal justice system is not a place for no young man to be, especially a young man of color.
Absolutely. Rob, do you have anything you want to say as we close this out?
Yeah, I got something to say. I think it's terrible, especially with my ex-wife was saying about the lawyers. The lawyers will rob you, take every dime from you, and make you homeless, make you have no money. They tell you all kind of good stories till they get your money, and then they do the opposite thing. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. And my son is going through something right now. But we'll fight together. We'll get through this. Mm-hmm. We will get through this.
Is he being treated for cancer now?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes. Yeah, he's being treated right now.
Okay.
Yes, and we just have to keep fighting so he can still get the treatment. Because if you don't fight for him to continue with the treatment, they will stop.
Bring it back in. Okay. I had a talk with him, I went and saw him today, so I had a talk with him. So he's going to take his treatment and everything. I had a serious talk with him. I told him I'm going to be there with him, I'm going to fight with him and everything. So we're going to get through this.
Your brother's 27 years old.
Yeah.
27 years old.
Yeah.
And this kind of hard.
I'm sorry, man. He's sick. He's really sick, man.
Yeah.
We got to do something for him, man.
Yeah. He's sick and he's been thrown into a dungeon.
Yeah, try to get through
and
this.
There are laws that do govern the criminal justice system, but it's not being applied. It's not being applied, and unfortunately, they do what they want to do, and it shouldn't be that way because there's laws in the books that are not being followed. Mm-hmm. From 2011 till now, that's almost, 5 years? 4 or 5 years?
4 years, yeah.
Yeah,
years,
I mean, so. Now he's very sick, and we got to make sure he goes to the doctor. We have to fight for that, or else he'll just sit in there.
Yeah.
And he's already given up.
Yeah.
He's the most, I'm going to tell you, anybody meet him will love him.
Mm-hmm.
He's met some very prestigious people in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever happened, we're trying to resolve it, but there's so much.
So much, man.
It's just,
we went through so much, went through so much with this. You know, it drains you. It drains you out, But you got to keep fighting to the end, And we will, and we will get through this.
Okay, Rob, Tricia, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll stay in touch.
All right, once again, that was Tricia and Rob, whose son has been locked up on Rikers Island for 3 years. And I want to tell folks, shortly after this interview was done, Tricia called me up, and she was crying. And she said she just wanted to make sure that she had emphasized enough that her son, before he was in jail, had been a really good person. And then he was arrested, and he spent 3 years in jail. Think about that one. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more from the Friday the 13th concert at Cook County Jail. Talk to you again next week. Thank you.